SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 91 with guest Mohammed Kabirun. Our guest today is Mohammed Kabirun. Mohammed is a product manager at Google. He leads Cloud SQL for SQL Server, working with engineering teams to deliver features and capabilities for enterprise to run SQL Server workloads on Google Cloud SQL. His expertise lies in architecting globally distributed data and information retrieval systems, databases, cloud database migrations, and vector embeddings. He spent several years working on applications with SQL Server, is a frequent speaker at industry conferences, meetups, and user groups, and an active community evangelist for SQL Server and a mentor for aspiring product managers. So welcome, Mohammed.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be here.
Indeed. Well, I was saying I haven't seen you for a while because I'll point out that you used to be Australian or living in Australia for a period of time, but you're now in Redmond.
That's right. Yeah, I have fond memories living in Australia, working on SQL Server, where my career started with. I've stuck on to SQL Server for quite a while now and worked with so many customers during my consulting days. And SQL Server is still, I feel, in my opinion, one of the finest database products out there. And hence, I'm still continuing to work on products and cloud that work on SQL Server.
Yeah. I must admit, I'm coming up 32 years now on it. And I have to say, I decided it was a very good decision to make at the time. So
absolutely.
Although at the time, it didn't necessarily feel like a strong decision because it was pretty basic in those days. But
yeah, and
great.
It's come a long way, right? Like it's evolved with times and it's kept up to every industry trend, as you can imagine, with, you know, from transactional databases to all the BI features that got us excited during the 2010s and analytics in late 2010s. And now we're entering a world of AI and still keeping up with all those demands.
Yeah, I think the only hesitation I have is sometimes I think they push things in just to be competitive in the market. That aren't strong offerings. Like I look at Graph and some of those things and they're not particularly strong. But overall, the product does a great job. I mean, even if you look at how they handle JSON and things like that, I mean, it was slow coming, but it's actually very good, the implementations that they've done there so far and more coming. So, looks good.
And you might know this better than I do. Like we've customized a lot of scripting and functionality into SQL Server, you know, with CLR assemblies and even with SSIS. I remember back in my consulting days, I used to build packages with custom scripts and .NET.
Yeah, sure.
I could do a whole lot of stuff, you know, that Microsoft didn't necessarily build at that time. And, you know, customers obviously had a lot of requirements that we couldn't meet, and we'd go and build all these custom scripts that run beautifully on the platform.
Yeah, extensibility is one of my long-term pet things, you know. any time I've been in like a room with the product group people in Redmond, and I'm invariably the one in the room with my hand up going, how do I build one of those, you know, whatever it is they're talking about. And a lot of the groups don't think about extensibility up front. Or extensibility is sort of an afterthought that never actually comes, you know, in a lot of scenarios. But the areas where they have done extensibility, it's been pretty good. But the SQL CLR is the odd one out, right? In fact, I even wrote a book on SQL CLR stuff years and years and years ago. But now I avoid it.
And you're absolutely right in doing that. Like you're absolutely right in avoiding it. Like we've evolved to a world where, you know, if you run cloud managed services, how do you support CLR assemblies?
Yeah, it's not there. And so because I can't use it in lots of different environments, it is now something I avoid actively.
Right.
Although I have to say, the performance of T-SQL like scalar functions and things like that built in SQL CLR are brilliant. Right. You know, by comparison with the T-SQL equivalents, but it's sort of interesting with that. It is one of the things I most yearn for, though, is a really good extensibility story in the database. You know, I want to be able to build. I have SDU tools where I have a library of functions, but
right.
I can't ship that like a library. You know, I have to install that in every database, for example.
Yeah.
I can't build the equivalent of system functions. I can't build functions with dynamic data type returns. You know, there's lots and lots of things that I can't do that way.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see the ability to do that sort of thing. I think it is one area where Postgres has a good story where it's much easier to build extensibility, you know, in that regard. So, but listen, you've gone to the dark side. You've gone to Google. Well, let's say it isn't necessarily the dark side. But why would somebody want to run SQL Server on Google?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me take a step back and share about what's available on Google Cloud to run databases in general, right? Like, there's a whole bunch of databases for folks who haven't heard. You know, Spanner is a popular database in Google.
Yeah.
That existed even before the cloud days. But we, primarily on the cloud, we have a Cloud SQL database service offering that offers SQL Server, Postgres, and MySQL, right? Mm-hmm. And the intent of running this as a Google Cloud SQL service is that we have customers who run workloads on SQL Server, and we have customers who also want the flexibility to run on other database engines like open source databases with Postgres and MySQL.
Yeah.
Now, what happens often in this case is when you have a customer who comes to one cloud service, it often is a huge migration effort for them to go from one to another.
Yes.
We wanted to sort of unify that experience in many ways, where if a user wants to run an application on SQL Server today, they could come on Cloud SQL and run it beautifully. But the moment they think there's a value add in running a Postgres equivalent of it, they don't have to go provision a brand new service environment, get their security folks, VPs and finance teams to approve a brand new service, they could just move within the same service to another database engine.
Mm-hmm.
And what we intended to do with that was to make that experience unified so that regardless of the database engine you choose, the way you provision it, the way you manage it, the way you configure maintenance schedules, the way you configure high availability should all look the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the nuances of the engine. So that's what we aim to intend with Cloud SQL as a service. And SQL Server is one of the important engines that plays a role in delivering that service. And we're seeing customers who run a lot of SQL Server workloads use the service primarily to not just to use Google Cloud, but also have that ability to use adjacent database engines like Postgres and MySQL.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
how many customers do you find run multiple engines, different engines?
I mean, almost every customer has a variety of workloads that run on different engines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we see some users have multiple workloads on SQL Server and a few on Postgres, and we also see otherwise. So there is this.
Why do they do that? So if you look at, say, someone who runs SQL Server and runs Postgres, is it a licensing cost issue?
There is multiple factors to consider here, Greg. One is, I think licensing does play a role in large enterprises where with hundreds and thousands of applications, it easily adds up. And that's caused some concern with some companies who want to move away from the licensing model. But also equally important, you're seeing a new era of like cloud native divisions within enterprises that are popping up who want to do cool, innovative stuff, build new applications that are born on the cloud. And those folks often generally prefer open source databases for the pace of innovation that's happening in that space. To your point, like extensibility, right? Like Postgres has a lot of extensibility that is very attractive to cloud native customers. And if you can imagine a large enterprise that has a small team of cloud native application developers who want to run applications and build applications as soon as possible, they often prefer open source databases, right? So you're seeing a spread of these popping up in multiple organizations, and then becomes a challenge, so to speak, for the central teams within the companies to manage all these databases together, right? And I we're seeing a trend where DBAs are also becoming more cross database engine centric or savvy.
I see a lot more SQL Server people or professionals basically who are now quite actively working with Postgres as well. I'm seeing quite a lot of that. In fact, what was interesting from a developer point of view, I looked yesterday, Bruce Momgen posted a list of here are all the things that are already known about what's changing in Postgres 17.
Right.
And I must admit, I looked through that list and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I wish we had a list of those things like that for SQL Server, you know, because the whole focus of nearly everything being done was improving the developer surface more so than their focus at the SQL Server team for so long has been improving the high availability story, the, you know, the real back end story. And that doesn't get people building new things on the platform, you know. And so there's been some, and in recent times, more activity in the developer side.
Yeah.
But it isn't the sort of stuff that's going to get exciting for developers. And importantly, the weird thing is that the people that most benefit from it in a cloud-first world are Microsoft themselves, are the ones who get the benefit out of the high availability story and, you know, all those things. But it's not something that a customer who talks to a SQL endpoint really sees any value out of. Yeah,
that's right. And to just to summarize the answer for your question on why should someone come to Google Cloud SQL for SQL Server, the product itself is the exact same SQL Server that we've been using for many years, right?
Yeah.
You get the same levels of control. You get the same interfaces that you can interact with. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the levels of control vary based on us offering a managed service. Like, we won't give you sysadmin permissions.
Yeah, so I suppose that's the first question. Obviously, you have VMs, so people can just run IaaS, SQL Server on VMs, and I mean, that's fine. In terms of, actually, even with that one as a starting point, the number one issue that most people raise with SQL Server on VMs in cloud environments is I/O performance. And what's that like?
Yeah, so with offering a managed service, for example.
Yeah, I was thinking rather than the managed service, even if you're just running VMs, what's the performance like available on?
Taking back, you know, going back to like 5-7 years ago when VMs were still evolving, or the compute infrastructure that was still evolving, you had limited choices with types of disks that underpin these VMs, right? I think we've come a long way in the evolution of cloud infrastructure now across, you know, cloud providers, where the disks that are available today in the market that cloud providers provide are fairly more extensive than they were like 5-7 years ago.
I'm just thinking that in Azure, for example, now there's a good range of performance that you can pick from in terms of the tiering of the storage. And I just wondered, I haven't looked in the Google ones.
Now you have a lot more flexibility in choosing your disk. So you could choose your machine type based on the vCPU and RAM, but you can also choose the type of disk that you want attached to it. And this, the I/O that are available with some of the more recent advancements in disks are far more superior.
Yeah.
So I think that story has significantly evolved.
But then there's managed services.
Correct. So with managed services as well, like we... when we started building Google Cloud SQL, we had limited options in terms of the disks that were available. But the story is again changing as disks evolve in compute infrastructure. We bring the same to managed services.
Yeah.
And when tiering comes to any cloud managed service, those sort of disks play a role in offering those tiers, right? In Google Cloud SQL today, we have different machine shapes that you can choose from. And when you choose those machine shapes, you can also associate them with a storage size.
Yeah.
Right. And that hardware generation for those storage size evolves over time.
So with the managed services, I suppose I'm trying to think about how managed the services are. So so I suppose to start with, even just migration, can we just do standard restores of databases? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So Google Cloud SQL for SQL Server allows you to migrate in multiple ways, right? You have the good old transactional replication that you can set up with Cloud SQL.
So I could replicate from an on-premises one or another cloud and replicate that into
That's actually a very popular choice. Most of our users still continue to use transactional replication with Cloud SQL as a subscriber, and they replicate data from an on-premise environment or another cloud environment.
It's so funny, actually. I see so many people in the SQL Server community just give transactional replication, they give replication as a whole, some sort of bad name. And I always think the thing is, a lot of that came initially because they're thinking about merge replication, not transactional. Right. But even there was this reputation where transactional is like this hard to work with, hard to manage thing and so on. And I've never quite felt like that. I've always found that as long as you configure it properly and think, there's usually just a knowledge gap in terms of getting past that. But we use it all the time, and it's one of the more reliable things we deal with,
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't agree with any of the those things. And we have online training for replication, and every week there's people doing it. So out in the market, people are using it, heavily.
And a lot of third-party tools also rely on it for migrations, right? And it's one of the superior technologies for logical data replication in my view.
Fact that we can even use Azure SQL databases as a subscriber that's been a game changer for us, because we have, on-premises databases at clients that just replicate into an Azure SQL database that's then used as the source of data for analytics and various things and so on. And it's just rock solid, it's so good. But
the same applies for Google Cloud SQL. Like, you can set up the replication with any on-premise source. What's more interesting is that under the hood, Google Cloud SQL is pretty much the same SQL Server engine, right?
Yeah.
Which is packaged up and managed as a service. So you get to bring in the same options that you would use in a normal SQL Server world. Transactional replication, backpack imports, full backup restores, transaction log backup restores, diff backup restores. So all those capabilities are available. In fact, transaction log backups and full backup restores are also very popular, right? For smaller tier or tier 3 applications that can afford to upload backups and restore them, full backups, and can afford some downtime, they just do a full backup restore.
In fact, we should say the primary reason I see people using transactional replication for migration is, of course, to have a small window for downtime, the time it changes. Yeah,
transactional replication is one, but for minimal downtime, T-log backups also play.
Just restore the last log backup.
And we're seeing that quite popular with our users, where they continuously quote unquote ship tree log backups to the cloud.
And so is it easy to set up the equivalent of log shipping and things like that?
Well, when you say the easy part is just uploading, right? How you restore it and manage that restoration part is automated with our DMS service. So you could use a database migration service that does all that for you. It runs a migration job underneath. It continuously picks up your transaction logs, continuously restores it, and off you go. If you want to do it manually, by all means, it's not as easy as doing it with a managed DMS offering.
Indeed.
But you could do the same. You could just run a script, a gCloud. In the Google Cloud world, we call it the gCloud CLI, which is the equivalent of your PowerShell, if you will.
Yeah.
So you could run a whole bunch of automated scripts that does that automatically for you and manage it as well.
What's the story with Agent? So I know when customers have been using RDS, for example, that sort of Agent is there, but it's not quite the same as Agent normally is. And so I'm just sort of wondering The story with SQL Agent?
There's no difference. You get the same SQL Agent. You can run your jobs. No changes to any mechanisms with SQL Agent jobs. All of that is supported. I think the interesting part is the message that I want to convey is Google Cloud SQL or SQL Server is pretty much running SQL Server packaged up as a managed service. Right? Yeah. The controls that we limit are primarily for things that we don't want customers to manage themselves because we're offering it as a managed service and we have certain SLAs and guarantees to keep up with, which is why we don't offer
sysadmin. What types of things are they?
Sysadmin is not an option in Google Cloud SQL. And so is it in most.
So again, that would impact what you could do in an agent job though, right?
Yeah. So to overcome that, what we provide as an option is you can certainly grant permissions. You can add roles, add users into roles and manage it that way. But it doesn't limit your ability to run these operations. Now, if you ask me for a vendor application, for example, that insists on having a sysadmin permission to configure a SQL agent job, that becomes slightly more challenging on a managed service.
Yeah.
But that applies to any cloud provider that provides a managed service in general, right?
Mm.
So those kind of controls are hard to come by. But other than that, we provide abilities for users to alter permissions and alter roles and create roles and add users into it to overcome some of these.
What about one of the things that I usually like in terms of Azure is the number of data centers, and that gives you a lot of control over where the data lives or physically resides. What's the current situation with the Google Cloud centers?
Look up the exact number of data centers. Mm-hmm. That keeps growing over time. But certainly we are on par with other cloud providers. We haven't seen any customers complaining of data residency. We're a global service and we have global users and customers, and we're seeing most of them are running locally for their data residency requirements. Including in Australia, which I know is super sensitive on data residency.
Yeah, it can. It certainly can be. The it's interesting with even that. I mean, the usual approach in Azure was to create data centers in pairs and have them at least 500 kilometers apart and in the same geopolitical region. I mean, that was the thing. Yeah. Is there a similar approach?
We have zones in Google Cloud, so we can separate out instances, for example, your database instances in two different zones, so that you have zonal separation in case of a primary going down. But we also, you've gotten into an interesting topic here with SQL Server on Google Cloud SQL. You get to configure both zonal and regional replicas. So you can have a cross-regional replica in a completely different region and have that promoted to being your primary in case of a regional outage. So that's an option. The interesting thing here is also that I want to get into the weeds of this. When you talk about regional replication or regional instances, you most likely have regional replicas for DR scenarios.
Yeah,
which is the case with Google Cloud SQL instances. So you can have a primary in region A and secondary in region B. And if the region A goes down, you could fail over. The interesting thing here is you have an option in region A itself to have another standby replica, right? Which allows you to fail over to the standby replica. In the Google Cloud SQL terminology, we call it a HA replica. And what this does is basically...
I mean, that's mostly what I normally want. I want local high availability and distance disaster recovery. Yeah,
correct. So with a local high availability instance here, we provision it under the hood with storage replication, right? So if your primary goes down, your storage is replicated to that other instance and instantly you could bring that other instance up online and continue your business operations. Now, the way we've done that is because we're running SQL Server in a managed offering and we are providing it with the connections and the attributes of Google Cloud, we don't rely on always on availability groups to provide this local HA replica. We use storage replication instead.
Yeah.
Right? So that allows us to offer this service to our customers regardless of the edition that they choose. So for example, you can have a standard edition Google Cloud SQL instance and still have this HA replica configured without the need for an availability group under the hood,
mm-hmm.
right? Which I know is a limitation on standard editions where you cannot have a replica unless you have an enterprise edition.
Right, so. Oh, nowadays you can have basic availability groups. So they are there. They introduced them primarily to replace, to have a real replacement for mirroring, basically.
Right.
There's a lot of people were still using mirroring.
Yeah,
because it was really simple to set up, and it just, again, just sort of worked. Right. And so they used to say, "Oh, use availability groups instead," and we always used to say, "Well, yeah, but it's not a direct replacement for mirroring." You know,
that's right.
And and of course, as you say, there was a lot of discussion with people saying, "Yeah, but what about the standard edition people?" You know, and right. that was a constant issue. Now you can set up a simple HA pair with basic availability groups, and you don't even have to have it in a cluster. You can just do certificate authentication and things like that when in a clusterless form. So, I mean, there are ways of doing that now with standard edition, but again, yeah, a lot of people find even that setup sort of thing a little challenging, and to me, one of the beauties of any of the managed services is that you don't have to have the people on board who know how to do that stuff.
And this experience is same across Cloud SQL offerings, regardless of SQL Server, Postgres, or MySQL, right? To my earlier point on unifying this user experience, like you would see the same levels of control and options on a UI, whether you're working with Postgres or MySQL or SQL Server. Like that's the intent of delivering the service. And I think customers really resonate with that. Especially, like I said, the DBAs who centrally manage their entire fleet of databases in an organization, it's pretty seamless for them to go from one to another.
It's actually interesting that on Postgres, if I look at the changes that were there in version 17 upcoming, one of the things I did note is the number of commits that were made by Microsoft to Postgres in version 17 is like extraordinary. And a lot of it is around high availability and so on because they did the Citus purchase and so on. But it's really interesting that because Microsoft wanted to offer and is offering Postgres as a service, again, they've been making all the commits and things and adding to the code to make that workable properly in Postgres. So, I think people don't realize how big a committer Microsoft is in the Postgres space. And it's making it possible for lots of people to do these things. So it's interesting.
That's right.
And so, look, that's good. In terms of licensing, I suppose, is the next question. Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com. Is the managed service something that comes with bundled licensing, or is it a bring-your-own-license thing? Or
On Google Cloud SQL, when you purchase or provision an instance, you get to choose the license edition that you want to pick. So you can purchase it as part of the bundle. When you provision it, it comes with the licenses. Any replicas that you create will also automatically factor that in. So that is provided by Google Cloud as part of the service. Unfortunately, we don't have bring your own licensing mechanisms on managed service today. You can certainly do that with a VM.
IaaS, Google Cloud.
That's right. Right now, we don't have a bring your own license type mechanism on Google Cloud SQL.
Do you have as yet a substantial pool of SQL Server people I suppose partners being the right word, who are primarily deploying on Google Cloud? Or do they tend to still be across multiple clouds?
No, we have certain set of customers who are uniquely on Google Cloud. And the reason for that is Google Cloud in general has a lot of adjacent services on top of database services that customers find valuable. Like BigQuery is a popular service. Customers often run analytics on BigQuery, and they want to have their transactional data close to their analytics platform. And hence, the need for running something like SQL Server on Google Cloud becomes even more prominent in that in that case. We have customers running Vertex AI models and running AI applications who, again, need access to training data, transactional data within their organization that want to stay close
to. Want to connect to that to get it. Yeah,
that's right.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, that's good. And so I'm trying to think the other aspects
I was going to suggest... You brought up the topic of licensing, right?
Yeah.
With Google Cloud SQL, we have an option. I know licensing is a very sticky topic. We try and, as much as we can optimize for customers' costs, we try and look at mechanisms within their estate, but also provide product features like turning off hyperthreading, right? So when you have a beefy machine with, like, let's say, 64 vCPUs or 128 vCPUs or what have you, and paying for those licenses can be expensive. Whereas the workloads might not need that many vCPUs, for example, in certain seasonalities. What you can do as a user is turn off hyperthreading, which will cut your...
The core count, the
vCPU count by half. And that reduces your licensing cost. And a lot of our customers and users have actually used that method without seeing significant differences in their performances, right? At least for workloads that they were able to switch those off. So that's...
Is there anything else that they need to know to do differently when working in the Google Cloud environment?
Look, consolidation keeps coming up a lot. We don't want customers or users to bring their old legacy baggages the way they've architected on premises, right? To make the best use of cloud, you know, we've been preaching this over the years, at least since cloud was born. Try and consolidate and use this cloud migration opportunity to actually look into your database.
To improve things.
Things and not just leave them.
That is refreshing to hear you say, because... It's one of the things I look at in even the Azure Architecture Center and things like that. The general approach with the cloud providers always seems to be to migrate, then transform.
Yeah.
You know? And the thing I find is that the customers who do that, it's never a good story because they end up taking so much baggage with them. And often then the migration takes much longer than what they were expecting it to be. And sometimes the trying to re-implement what they had in their mess on premises ends up being the hardest part of the migration. And it's something potentially they didn't even need in the first place. And so I see many scenarios where they end up spending an absolute fortune and taking a long period of time. But the worst part is they then don't have available funds or the appetite to then do the transformation. And from the user's point of view, that's the thing that would have actually, and even from the company point of view, that's the thing that would have brought the benefits.
You're spot on. Like, you know, I think part of the challenge is also where large enterprises operate, right? Like the application teams are so busy doing the day-to-day mundane stuff. Where does one have an opportunity to sit down and re-architect and consolidate their application or modernize it before moving to the cloud? So everyone's time crunched and everyone just wants to get to the cloud as soon as possible. But once they get there, again, they don't find an opportunity.
The question is why? See, that's an interesting thing. Like we say, so many of them want to get to the cloud as soon as possible, but the question is why? Like, what do you see as the primary driver there? Is it
some of the things are leadership led, right? Like a leader in an organization has made a decision to move to the cloud and, you know, that is mandated as a requirement across the organization. And many leaders out there are using the cloud. I think the story is becoming even more stronger now because of the need to build generative AI applications and running these models that are available on the cloud, right? Instead of, imagine starting a new generative AI project without having access to these models. Like model management, MLOps, building your own model, training them is such a hard thing to do on premises.
All of that.
Right?
That's a perfect example of something where you want to click, point, drag, and then it just works. Yeah.
That's right. So I think a lot of this is leadership driven. And often application teams are following the strategies of these organizations where they want to move to the cloud. But there are also a good chunk of customers and users out there who have a good hybrid mix, right?
Yeah.
Where they're leaving certain applications that are on-premises and that demand the kind of sensitivity and needs of an on-premise environment. They're leaving them on-premises and moving the rest to the cloud.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting. I was in a client meeting earlier in the week, and they were talking about database compatibility levels, and
right.
they had, you know, some of them back in level 90, you know, like 2005 level and so on. And
right.
the question is, when you're then moving the servers that were still 2012 or something,
yeah.
trying to re-platform them in 2022, those compat levels don't work anymore.
Right.
But right. then they were saying there were other sites where there were a large number of, you know, that level or lower and so on.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to hear them say then either upgrading or replacing or just let them die. You know, that was the first time I'd heard somebody like really spelling that out. Yeah.
Right. You know, you'd be surprised, like we come across instances where, or database instances rather, that people often even struggle to find out who the owners are of these
yes.
databases. Never been used for multiple years. No application team has ownership of this, but they still sit there in an on-premise environment. And when you look at migrating...
And they're not game to get rid of it, right?
Yeah.
and sometimes they don't even know who's using it, but... It's
a strategy of leave it if it runs, and why do you want to touch it and break things?
Well, actually, one of the things that I found at this particular site is that some of the databases that were still there in compat level 90 were simply that they were restored there a long time ago for just retaining it like an archive. Of course, and nobody's ever touched it since. But when they're then doing the planning on how do we move forward, they're looking at these things that were still sitting there that nobody's using, and then they're wondering about how to migrate them up. So yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah. What are you seeing out there, if I may ask you, with Google Cloud SQL customers or users that you've come across?
Very little as yet.
Okay.
And yeah, that's why I was really interested to see what the situation is with that. Yeah, I do see... I mean, obviously, most of the people I see are in Azure or on-premise SQL Server. I see quite a lot that are in AWS VMs there. I see a smaller number who are on RDS, but, you know, a notable number that was AWS RDS. But yeah, I don't see all that many as yet with GCS, and it's something that I have been wondering about, because again, you know, it's not just a two cloud provider world. You know?
We're relatively new compared to AWS and Azure, right? Google Cloud SQL is the newest child of cloud services, database services in comparison. But we still run a lot of large enterprises and cloud native customers on Google Cloud SQL Server. And interestingly, we come across customers who even push the limits of SQL Server and are running successfully on Google Cloud SQL.
That's great. And so listen, Mohammed, is there anything that you've got coming up of interest in the near future, or conferences where people might see you?
We've got a lot of features constantly in the works, and that we'll continue to roll out. Cloud blogs on Google Cloud is the best source to keep up with information. And our Google Cloud SQL documentation is a great source of knowledge and information for folks wanting to learn. In terms of conferences, start thinking where, not in the next couple of months at least. I'm still thinking.
Anything
there? A couple of SQL Server conferences that I'm that I'm looking at. I should possibly look at speaking at them.
Yes. Indeed. Actually, what's the approach with documentation? Do you just point people at the SQL Server documentation at the Microsoft site, or?
No, we have a Google Cloud SQL documentation. Back, and you can go in and read all about the features that we offer. We go into detail about replication, migrations, data protection, backups, maintenance, all of that stuff. For things like SQL Server deep engine based knowledge, we will have links to Microsoft documentation for those.
Yeah,
right. Like for example, with let's pick an example. SSRS. It was a feature that we recently announced on Cloud SQL.
In fact, that's a thing that I did mean to ask you about before you go, is that what about the other services? Analysis services, reporting services, integration services.
We're slowly lighting them up. So SSRS was the first one to go off the rank, and we announced them last month in preview, where you can run an SSRS report using Cloud SQL by hosting the SSRS tempdb, the report server tempdb on Cloud SQL, and having the Windows application where you can author and edit it using a GCE VM. Unfortunately, Microsoft doesn't have an SSRS equivalent that can run as a service. It still is reliant on a Windows machine that needs to run it.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes. And even the installation. I don't think we'll ever see one either. Yep. And so what's the demand from the customers been like for reporting services?
Reporting services is quite out there.
I was actually surprised
to see that.
This is a thing that, you know, if you listen to most of the Microsoft people speaking, it's like it doesn't exist anymore, you know. And to me, I did a blog post a while back saying, you know, the reports of my death are, you know, exaggerated type thing. Like, there's so many people using reporting services. And again, it's another thing we have online training and people are doing it every week, you know, it's not, there's many, many scenarios where it is the right solution, you know, and yet it's like this poor orphaned child, almost comes into the, I think of abandonware is almost my word that I would use for it. And the problem is that where it will eventually die off is that it just won't get the love required to make it work in newer environments. You know, I won't hold my breath waiting for, say, a new Blazor native version of a report viewer or things like that. That would have been
amazing, though. Like, imagine what you just said.
Yes. It was reality. So I'm not expecting to see any of those things, you know, but there are a lot of people who would love to see it, right?
That's right. Yeah, we saw quite a lot of interest out there with that. And it makes sense, right? It was free with SQL Server. You didn't need to have additional licensing or anything for that. You know, you basically run SSRS on the same box where you run the engine, and off you go. Let the whole company build reports off it. I still see so many pixel perfect printable reports being generated out of that with many customers.
Indeed.
It's funny, when I was doing my consulting days back in the day, and I think there was one interesting customer who built payroll reports, pay slips rather, on SSRS.
And totally. There's no reason you couldn't do it. We were certainly systems that we used to build. Yeah, we absolutely had pay slips and things and stuff that were on reporting services. Yeah, no problem at all. It's interesting. I don't think that – I love Power BI, but I don't think it's the answer for – you know, all particularly operational reporting. I just don't think it is, you know. And so interesting. And analysis services?
So analysis services is currently not supported in Cloud SQL. And so is SSIS.
Both could run in a VM, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can certainly run, and that's how we see customers using it in Cloud SQL. They run analysis services, SSIS, as packages on a VM. SSIS was one of those things where you had a dependency for a report server database to be like reliable on a managed service. It's funny, again, you know, customers actually think reporting services database should be reliable, secured, just like any other database, and even replicated if when you have replication, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they run really critical applications of SSRS, and they needed that support. So that was the first one off the rank. We managed to get that out the door last month, and yeah, customers were waiting for that. SSIS is an interesting one because SSIS also has something similar with SSIS DB. So Cloud SQL doesn't support it yet, but the customers run it on a VM today.
Yeah, interesting. And that had a SQL CLR requirement for that one as well. So yeah.
But if you think about it, right, like SSIS was basically ETL, and there are cloud native services that do ETL.
Mm-hmm.
Google Cloud, Cloud Data Fusion is a classic example. A lot of our customers have actually migrated off SSIS to Cloud Data Fusion to do ETL-like processing.
Yeah, and look, in the Azure environment, we use Azure Data Factory all the time. And so I would say I actively avoid moving any integration services packages. I know it's painful, but I usually rewrite them as some native cloud thing. Yeah.
I'm sure you must be rewriting a lot of script tasks in SSIS.
That sort of thing. But I just think it's the best thing. I mean, if I still have to build integration on premises, though, it's still the obvious thing. You know, I see many people trying to use the cloud solutions for that, and then they end up doing silly things like dragging the data up to the cloud and then back down again, and you just go, no,
right.
You know, don't do that.
Yeah,
there are lots of options for doing it the other way. But yeah, no, I think the, as I said, Data Factory is the typical go-to one we had, but even that, I mean, it's still got so many things you could do with integration services that you just can't do in ADF. Without using the integration services runtime.
Well, you know, if you really want to push the limits, you could do it all with stored procedures, right?
Yeah, well, look, a lot are, not quite, because, you know, we often are calling web services and things that would be very messy to do any other way. Yeah, that sort of thing. In fact, one that I'm totally struggling with at the moment is I've got a people who I think shouldn't, are new to building APIs and things, but they built a REST-based API. And when we make a call, we actually get sent back a link that we have to then download a SQLite database.
Oh, wow.
And that's what comes back. And then I'm trying to work out in ADF, how do I open
how do you
up
actually do
and
that?
Process a SQLite database? And so I'm like, And so I'm reaching out and thinking I'm going to have to put that in a, because SQLite, you can't have anything except a normal local file path.
That's right.
And so I'm having to like put it in a storage, like a file share, and then spin up an Azure function to go off and read this to just pull the
Someone
data.
Someone was very creative.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's like, you know, I just think, please don't do that.
When you thought JSON was hard enough to...
I'll take JSON any day, you know, compared to, please... Please send me a SQLite file. Yeah. And it's huge too. It's gigabytes, you know. So it's like, I noticed the local storage on the Azure functions, you know, if you're in consumption mode, is limited to 500 megs. I was like, that's not going to work either. So I've been trying so many things. Oh my goodness. You know, it was one of those projects where you think, this shouldn't be that hard. It is.
When you saw the SQLite file.
as soon as that. So that's all good. Hey, so listen, thank you. Coming up to time. So look, thank you so very much for your time today, Mohammed. It's been great to chat.
It was a pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.